This interview is one in a series recorded by the Charlie Waller Memorial Trust as part of a Health Education England funded programme to transform outcomes for children and young people with extra vulnerability to mental health difficulties. The series includes interviews with a range of experts who each have specialist knowledge on the needs and experiences of a particular vulnerable group. This is an interview with Professor Neil Humphrey.
So, first of all, can I ask you to introduce yourself, Neil?
So my name is Neil Humphrey. I'm a Professor of Psychology of Education at the University of Manchester, where I'm also the head of the Manchester Institute of Education.
Thank you. So I've come today to talk to you a little bit about bullying, and the first question I'd like to ask is what we know about the impact of bullying on mental well-being.
Okay. So I suppose the first part of the answer is about what I would say is about what we mean by bullying, and generally speaking, the kind of agreed definition is around bullying's about a power imbalance. It's about behaviour that's intended to harm, and it's also something that is repeated over time. And what we see with bullying and its impact on mental health is there's good evidence to suggest children who are bullied repeatedly are more likely to experience suicidal thoughts. They're more likely to experience significant levels of anxiety and depression, and it also impacts on their attainment and attendance in school. So children who are who experience significant levels of bullying are less likely to achieve well, but also less likely to attend school. And that outcome in particular is intuitive, because if I was being bullied at school, one of my strategies might be I'm not going to go to school then. But it does impact on their attainment as well. So children who are bullied, it erodes their learning.
And do we know anything about the sort of factors within the school environment that can influence the incidence of bullying?
Well, there's relatively limited amount of research on the kind of school level factors. There's lots that's been done that tells us about kind of individual factors, which we can come to later. But in terms of what we do know, there's research that suggests that bullying is more likely to occur in larger schools. And it might be something as simple as the fact that in larger schools it's easier for it to go undetected than in smaller, closer-knit schools. There is some evidence to suggest that the climate of the school is important, and obviously when it comes then to thinking about what we can do about it, that's a really key part. But actually having an ethos and climate that is respectful of diversity and intolerant towards this kind of aggression is really important. And also schools actually having a really clear and unambiguous policy in relation to what bullying is and what the consequences are for those who are perpetrators of bullying. So where there is ambiguity around that, there is much more likely to be high levels of bullying. And while it does happen in every type of school, there is, I think, some evidence to suggest that it's more likely to happen in mainstream settings for certain children than in specialist settings, although as I said it happens everywhere. There's nowhere where bullying doesn't happen in terms of schools.
And in terms of the school's policy, presumably they actually need to do something with that. So having the policy itself isn't the...
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's about the enactment of the policy, absolutely. So there's a legal requirement for schools to have an anti-bullying policy, but then you're absolutely right. So it's really about then what action is taken to embed that policy and to make sure that it's implemented, to make sure that when bullying occurs, children feel able to report it. So one of the studies that we did, which was about children with autism's experience of bullying, was a qualitative study where we interviewed kids, and one of the key things that they said to us about how likely they are to report it is the extent to which they think anything would be done about it when they did. And we had a significant number of young people who said, what's the point? I've told my teachers before and nothing gets done about it. So actually having action to address bullying among staff in the school, but also kids actually seeing that in action and feeling therefore confident that they could report bullying and know that it will be dealt with and know that it will be addressed. But, you know, more broadly than that, actually having preventive strategies in place, so not just reactively dealing with bullying when it happens, but trying to stop it happening in the first place. And that's the big challenge, and that's more than around having that ethos and climate that's reflective of, you know, diversity and a more accepting kind of nature is key.
So we mentioned the sort of factors within the environment. In terms of the children themselves, are there factors that we know about that make a child more likely to bully another child?
Yeah, so there was a big piece of research done for the Department for Education about 7 years ago by Green and colleagues, and they looked at, they had one of these big longitudinal data sets, and they looked at the factors that were kind of risk factors, I suppose, if you like, for, you know, who's more likely to be bullied. And what they found is things like a peak at age 14, so the highest prevalence of bullying is when children are kind of at the end of key stage three, and then it kind of tails off a little bit as they come to the end of compulsory education. Children who have special educational needs are more likely to be bullied than other children, and what our research has shown is that particularly young people on the autism spectrum, even more so than other children with other types of special educational needs, are at greater risk. Children who are in care, children who are young carers, and children who have changed school, so kids coming into school halfway through secondary or halfway through primary, who are new and don't necessarily therefore have the kind of friendship networks that might protect them from bullying, are more at risk. In terms of gender, it varies quite significantly because it depends on the type of bullying. So boys are more likely to engage in and be subjected to the kind of physical, the direct physical aggression side of bullying, and girls, the evidence suggests, are more likely to engage in and be the victim of the more indirect relational bullying, where it can be not shoving them to the ground, for example, but excluding them from activities or talking about them behind the back and those sorts of things. So gender's a kind of a variable one, but those are the kind of the key factors that Green's research and other people's research have shown to be, you know, the higher prevalence of bullying among those young people. And what we found in one of the studies we did with kids on the autism spectrum is that there's a kind of a cumulative effect. So some of those factors also apply to kids on the spectrum. So we found kids on the spectrum were more likely to be bullied around the end of key stage three. We found that they were more likely to be bullied if they were in mainstream as opposed to special school. We also found kids who were more socially vulnerable, is the phrase that's used in research, but kids who are, because of the nature of their autism, perhaps more easily manipulated by other children. So we have qualitative data, anecdotal data that supports this, but kids who, because they want to be part of a kind of a friendship group or a social network, get persuaded to do things that are going to get them in trouble, and it's done, you know, for the entertainment of other kids, but then that in itself is a form of bullying. Those other kids are using that power imbalance to get the young person in trouble. We also found kids on the spectrum who used public transport to get to school, which we were quite puzzled by, but that was a really significant finding in this big study of about 800 kids that we looked at. And those where we knew they took the bus to school or the train to school were more likely to be bullied. And, you know, eventually the explanation hit us. It's another venue in which there is minimal adult supervision. You know, so it's like the playground at lunchtime where there's only a handful of adults around who can intervene, and it's a confined space with lots of kids, so it made sense then that actually just is a venue where kids are more likely to be bullied. And then the other thing that we found was that children with autism who were in the old kind of SEN assessment and provision framework were at what that was called School Action Plus, but that would now be called SEN but without an education, care and health plan. Those kids who not yet got a statement or an education, care and health plan, those were the kids who were also more likely to be bullied. And again, that was to do with the fact, we think, that the kids who already have a statement or an education, care and health plan tend to have the more significant complex difficulties. The kids who are kind of at that earlier stage, the difficulties might be milder. So on the one hand, they don't get the intensive adult support and supervision in school. But on the other hand, they have those social difficulties and they're marked out as different by other children, so it kind of makes them, you know, they're kind of caught between two places in a sense. So those kids were more likely to be bullied as well.
And in terms of the children doing the bullying, do we know anything about those sorts of factors?
Well, it used to be, I mean, I think this is a bit of a tricky one, because most of the research, I think, tends to focus on the victims of bullying, but there is quite a bit nowadays on the perpetrators of bullying. And it used to be assumed that bullies were lacked social intelligence. It used to be the kind of stereotypical bully would be this kind of unthinking thug. But actually what the research shows is that it's not the case at all. And in fact, actually, some children who bully are remarkably socially intelligent, and actually their social intelligence, their emotional intelligence, enables them to bully in ways that can go undetected, for example, because they're able to manipulate people and things. So, but in terms of other kind of characteristics, I think it does tend to vary quite a lot. So you'll get children from poorer backgrounds, more affluent backgrounds. You'll get children who are low attainers, high attainers. There isn't as much as a neat profile among the research about what we know about bullies compared to the victims of bullying. And you also then get these children who would be referred to as bully victims, who are at once perpetrators and also victims. And we've found with some research that children on the autism spectrum, some children on the autism spectrum fall into that category, that on the one hand they're bullied, quite often mercilessly, but then also they might engage in similar kinds of behaviour with other children because they're kind of mimicking what they've seen. They're just, you know, reacting in a way that seems more appropriate to them. This is being done to them, so they do it to other people. And you see that quite a lot with bully victims. They engage in behaviour that is seen to antagonise other children. And again, they may not be aware that they're doing it, but this is, like I said, a particular subset of children are both bullies and victims.
So we talked a little bit about some of the factors that make it more likely that children on the autistic spectrum with special educational needs are more likely to be targeted by bullies. Are there any others that we've not thought about so far?
Well, I think the more general point around that group of kids being more likely to be bullied, I think, is to do with, you know, we've kind of hypothesised that it's to do with the fact that autism is a, you know, what people refer to as a kind of a hidden disability. So it's one of those situations where other children see behaviour that's very different from what they expect. And because there isn't any obvious indication as to why that behaviour is so different, they engage in kind of behaviour like bullying that distances them socially from those young people. So it's kind of our hypothesis that it's born of ignorance, if that makes sense, that because the peer group don't understand autism and don't understand why a young person thinks, feels and behaves the way that they do, they mark them out for ridicule. So that's as a general point. That might also apply to other special educational needs, of course, but I think autism's a particular case because of its nature. But that then also gives us opportunities to start to think about intervention as well, because if that's partly what's underpinning that bullying, then there are things that we can do to kind of address that by raising awareness and raising understanding and things like that. One of the other factors that I didn't touch upon that we found in our study was children who, and it comes back to that kind of bully victim status, children who have an autism spectrum condition like Asperger syndrome. And in fact, the kids with Asperger syndrome diagnosis were more likely to be bullied. But I think, again, that goes along with the idea of the kind of milder social difficulties, but still presenting in a way that other children see as very different. But also children on the autism spectrum who also had kind of behavioural issues, who struggled to regulate their behaviour. Those were the kids who were also more likely to be bullied. And again, I think it's that kind of behaviour that other children might view as antagonistic because they don't understand what's behind it. So those were other features that we found in our research, and other researchers in America and Canada have found similar kinds of things. So there's a kind of convergence of evidence around that.
Okay. So the environment is a thing that you see as needing to change. Yeah. The understanding and other children and young people's awareness of the difficulties that they're peers are having or might be experiencing in terms of those relationships.
Very much so. So I think the kind of way for us to start to address this is, first of all, acknowledging that there's an issue. I think it's quite common practice, particularly in relatively high-performing schools, for the narrative to be that doesn't happen here, when in actual fact all the research tells us that whenever you get, you know, a group of children together, or sometimes a group of adults together, there's going to be some kind of power imbalance and there's going to be some kind of bullying. So acknowledging that this is an issue in every school, I think, is a starting point, and not kind of burying our heads in the sand around it. And then, yeah, addressing issues in the environment, addressing issues of kind of social understanding and social skills with the young people themselves, but again, not focusing on that, so not making the young people with autism the problem, in inverted commas, actually addressing the skills that they need to understand bullying and to understand when it's occurring and how to report it and those kinds of things, but also looking at the peer group, looking at the adults in the school. It's a kind of, you know, it's everybody's business to address, but I think definitely the kind of the peer group understanding side of things is a really ripe area for intervention, because I think, you know, like I said, our hypothesis is a lot of the bullying of kids on the autism spectrum is born from ignorance and kind of a lack of understanding of difference. That's, schools can sometimes shy away from approaches that we might recommend to deal with that, like, you know, educating other kids about autism and things, because they think it's going to single young people out. But it can be done in really sensitive ways, and it doesn't have to be done in such a way that you go, oh, that's John and he's got autism and this is what autism means. You know, we start by educating kids about difference, and from there to difference in relation to disability, and from there to autism, and from there, kids, you don't need to tell kids, they kind of make the link for themselves. And there's a lot of work in the States that's been done around how we can effectively carry that message to the peer group. So what are the optimal ways to educate other children and raise awareness of autism as an issue in school? You know, even simple things like, who should the person be who's actually, if it's an assembly, for example, how should that message be conveyed? Who should convey it? And there's some really nice, elegant studies done where they've looked at, well, actually, if it's somebody who is seen as a kind of a trusted member of staff, then children are much more likely to retain the information and change their behaviour than if it's just the head teacher, because the head teacher's the authority. So in some circumstances, it's better handled by somebody who's not necessarily the expert on autism in the school, which might be the Senko, but somebody who the kids know and trust and like. So even simple things like that that can raise awareness among the peer group can be really quite powerful. But they've got to be delivered alongside, you know, work with the staff, work with the students who are affected, and dealing with it comprehensively. So looking at bullies, looking at victims, looking at bystanders, because of course you know you might be engaging in bullying, you might be a victim of bullying. The rest of the school community of children are in some ways bystanders, so it's kind of addressing it with everybody rather than just targeting and punishing the bullies or targeting the victims. It's about a whole school kind of approach to it.
Are you aware of any peer education approaches? When you were saying about a teacher of particular influence, might that also be the case with peers who have that sort of influence?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so the body of work that's been done in the States, I'm struggling to remember the guy's name. I can pull it up later and send you the information. But they've done all kinds of things to do with, you know, it needn't necessarily be an adult. It could be peer education. And one of the very good schools that we've worked with in Greater Manchester, who've done a lot of work in this area, use peers as advocates. They have former pupils who come in and talk about autism. They, you know, they do lots of work that's then, you know, peers or other young people doing the awareness raising as opposed to the adults. And again, that, you know, the anecdotally that kind of stuff can work, as long as it's done really sensitively and as long as it's kind of planned properly, it can work wonders in terms of developing other children's understanding of what's, you know, what's not a very well kind of understood issue, particularly for young people. It's not particularly well understood among adults, but you know, for, particularly for young people, although we're, you know, a lot further on than we were 20 or 30 years ago when I was at school. So
we've talked about what schools can do. Are there things that we know that families can do?
Well, I think one of the things we've learned from having spoken to young people on the autism spectrum and their parents, in addition to teachers and other kids, is we know actually that parents are a really crucial part of this process. Parents also will typically report that they feel the kind of the emotional brunt of it, in as much as children who are being bullied during the school day and that anxiety is building and building and building and building, but they kind of keep a lid on it, and then they get home, and we've had parents say, you know, he comes home and we just get both barrels because it's just been built, you know. So parents kind of feel the brunt of it, and they'll also feel the brunt of it in terms of the really negative impact on mental health and things like that. So it's a distressing issue for parents. And one of the key things, I think, is parents helping with supporting young people who are victims of bullying, helping and being advocates for them in terms of the reporting process, and also helping in terms of not taking no for an answer. So we've, again, anecdotally had parents say, you know, again, they've spoken to school and school haven't done anything, and that's just not good enough. So, but they feel powerless. Again, it's, you know, power imbalance. They feel powerless because they say, well, what else can we do? We've reported it and nothing is happening. But I think the parents have more influence, I think, increasing influence than they did, you know, in years gone by, and particularly around issues relating to special education. You know, parent voice and young people's voice is now hopefully a key part of policy. So they have more influence than they previously did, but it's about being resilient, and it's about kind of, you know, like I said, not taking no for an answer and involving other parents where necessary, and but again, it's part of a whole community and a whole school approach. You know, parent alone isn't going to work, young person alone, educating the peer group alone, it's a kind of a jigsaw puzzle, if you like, and if only half of the pieces are in place, then it's going to, you know, it's going to be a struggle. I think one of the other things that parents are really can be really useful with is, particularly for young people on the autism spectrum, is one of the things that we found with the work that we've done is there is sometimes misunderstanding among young people as to what constitutes bullying. So, you know, a classic example from one of our interview studies we did with a young person on the autism spectrum was this young person felt they were the victim of bullying because other young people in the class, two rows behind them, were chewing gum, and the sound of the chewing gum really, it was a sensory sensitivity issue, and he believed that that was bullying, and he believed that they were doing it intentionally and so on. And actually, when we then dug into it, it turned out these girls that were chewing gum had no clue, genuinely no clue whatsoever, that this was, so, you know, so it's about kind of understanding what is and isn't bullying, what's intended and what's not intended, but then also that understanding of, on the opposite side of things, kids actually not understanding sometimes that they are being bullied. So, you know, behaviour that you and I might observe and go, well, that's clearly bullying behaviour, and the young person doesn't necessarily, because of the difficulties with social understanding, doesn't necessarily realise that that's what's actually happening. So kind of parents can play a really crucial role in helping young people to understand, alongside teachers, in helping young people understand what's intended and what's not, what's, you know, what's bullying and what's not, so that there's not over-reporting and so that there's not under-reporting. So it's making sure that it's addressed when it actually is bullying.
Is there any question that I haven't asked you that you wish I had?
The only thing that I think I would add would be around when I was talking about the kind of the different members of the school community all having a role to play. One key area which I didn't mention was around teacher beliefs and teachers' kind of understanding of bullying. And there was a study which I tend to cite in the presentations that I do on this issue that looked at teachers' beliefs about how and why bullying occurs and the consequences of bullying. And the results are quite striking because there was a significant proportion, I think it was an American study, a significant proportion of teachers who were surveyed in this study whose responses were that bullying is essentially just something that happens. It's like a rite of passage. It happens to everybody, and therefore you don't really need to do anything about it. Now, of course, that's completely incongruent with what the research tells us about the impact on mental health and all those kinds of things. But from the point of view of if that's the belief set that you hold as an adult in school, that this is just, it's just something that kids do and it'll be fine, then you're way less likely to actually intervene and do anything about it, and you're way less likely to take kids seriously when they report these concerns. So there is a job for us to do around educating the workforce to understand what we know about the consequences of bullying, that this isn't just something that happens, that this isn't just something that's, you know, going to go away naturally and not have any long-term consequences. This is actually something that can and does destroy people's lives and has effects all the way through into adulthood. So there, you know, there's research to show that the effects of bullying can last a lifetime for some young people, and you know, that alone suggests we need to do more about it.
Thank you for listening. If you have found this resource useful, please consider making a charitable donation to CWMT by texting TALK18 and the amount to 70070. And to learn more about the work of the Charlie Waller Memorial Trust, please visit cwmt.org.uk.